We are live.
Hello, I'm Simon Mertep. This is Crave. It's a podcast and it's dedicated to film and to music, to theatre, television, just about anything that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe lately.
This week, with all the indoors weather around the country of late, and it has been grim, let's face it, and with another school holidays around the corner, there is no better time than to catch up with a film or a TV series. So, with that in mind...
We cast our eye over one typical kids' holiday movie, and that is Despicable Me 3.
For those looking for something a little bit more grown up, a little bit more sophisticated... we have a cinematic adaptation of the Daphne du Maurier novel, My Cousin Rachel, with Rachel Weisz as Rachel in the lead.
Fancy that. Also, another adaptation we want to talk about, this time of the Margaret Atwood novel, The Handmaid's Tale, not at the movies, in this case, you'll find it online, as a 10-part series, no less. And we also want to mention a movie that hasn't come out yet, but based on... absolutely true life events, not too far from your homeland, Mr. McCabe.
Indeed, you're talking about The Journey,
a
somewhat contrived but also rather compelling take on events during the Northern Ireland peace process.
Yeah, fascinating. Look forward to that a bit later, but that's later.
Absolutely. So we'll start with The Inner Child, shall we, Simon? Despicable Me the Third. Did it transport you to the days of your youth?
I have to say, and this is the best I can say, only partly so, Steve. We see so many of these types of films these days, don't we? This had some good bits. I liked the opening sequence. I liked the finale. There was a lot of satisfying action going on there. But the big middle chunk of it, it all felt a bit sappy and saccharine and oversweet for my taste anyway. Better than some of these, but it's not up there with the likes of, say, a Toy Story or The Incredibles or Finding Nemo, which I thought, you know, were really excellent of that type of film. Basically, I hadn't seen the previous two of this, but Gru, played by Steve Carell, was a bad guy, has turned into a good guy, and basically he's now catching bad guys. It's a good plot summary, isn't it? And in this case, he finds he's got a twin he didn't know about, also played by Steve Carell. And they go to chase a bad guy called Balthazar Bratt, played by Trey Parker, or voiced by Trey Parker.
What a great name.
Wonderful name. And a good bad guy, too. He commits his crimes dancing to 80s pop songs.
Ooh, now there's a thing.
It was, and the opening sequence, which was done to a selection of Michael Jackson songs, was really good and very enjoyable and very fun and quite refreshing and, excuse me, it worked very well. You can tell it's winter because I'll be coughing from time to time. But the middle did smag, got very sag and got schmaltzy. There's a unicorn story thread line running through it.
There is.
Yeah, of course. Lucy, voiced by Kirsten Wiig, I think is very, very good. She's off on a sort of a bit of a sidebar about how she can prove herself to be a real mother. The kids are adopted and she has to prove her worth. But that kind of didn't really go anywhere. Steve Carell carries the film, really, and he does kind of well. But I actually wanted to hear and see more of the bad guy, Balthazar Bratt. I thought he was very good. So I would like to see more of him and a little less of the other storylines. The Minions, are you familiar with The Minions?
I was going to say, you can keep Gru and all the rest. I want to hear about The Minions. I love The Minions.
I kind of thought they weren't that prominent, certainly not in the plot line at all in this film. They were kind of tacked on the sides here and there. Quite fun, but not a lot of screen time. So I don't know, I think they got the balance not quite right in this one. I think one of the problems might be why it didn't really, really sing for me was the whole thing of having a bad guy someone who was a bad guy, who's now a good guy. Once you're a good guy, you're not that interesting anymore, I kind of think, you know?
Yeah, so, we don't want redemption.
No. So there are a few genuine laughs, but not that many. So sitting in the middle of the pack somewhere.
Now, to be fair,
yes.
I've got to tread very delicately here. I suggest that you are possibly not the target demographic. I'm not trying to call you old or anything, but yeah, you're old.
And I'm just about to have another birthday. So, yes, you're quite right. I'm not, you know, but these films are they not, Steve, very good at pitching themselves at kids and adults at the same time. They usually manage to do that very well.
When they are done well, they tend to straddle that line quite well, don't they?
Yeah.
So how did Despicable Me 3 pull it off?
Well, what I can tell you is that there were some other young kids with grown-ups in this auditorium with me.
Yeah.
And I didn't hear too much reaction from the kids.
Oh, dear. That's not a good sign, is it?
No. I mean, a little titter now and then, but... a little bit of a odd laugh or two from the grown-ups. It wasn't awful by any means. I don't want to diss it, but it didn't sail. So, especially when the bar is set pretty high these days. So I'm not saying don't spend your money on a ticket, but just for a bit of a diversion.
Know what you're going into, I think, is the moral there.
Yeah.
Fair enough, then. Well, I think we should move on from that fairly quickly. Should we shift gears a little bit?
I think we should shift gears a lot and head to Northern Ireland, shall we?
Yes. You're not going to find quite the same sort of broad humour there, I wouldn't have thought.
No, though, and interestingly, one of the two characters here is rather good at droll comments and asides, is he not?
Oh, I know where you're going with that one. So let's do the quick setup, shall we? This is a film called The Journey.
Yes.
Directed by Nick Hamm and set in the 1990s during the peace process between the Catholic and the Protestant sides of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. And the somewhat contrived setup is we've got Ian Paisley, the loyalist leader, the firebrand preacher is always referred to. And we've got Martin McGuinness, who's the number two from Sinn Féin, and who is basically coming out at this stage as an ex-commander of the IRA, who allegedly has dropped in a few times because, you know, at least in the 90s, we were still going through the motions of pretending that he hadn't been or that he was still undecided. But the idea is that Paisley has to get back to Belfast from their meetings in St Andrews in Scotland. And so he has to drive as far as Glasgow Airport. And so the argument goes that if he's going, then one of the Republicans has to go as well. And so McGuinness gets the nod. And so the two of them find themselves in the back seat of a people mover going across the centre of Scotland for about an hour and a half in terrible weather.
Yes.
And these two men are implacable enemies. They have been on the opposite sides of basically a civil war for decades. And they despise each other and they despise everything that each despises, everything the other stands for.
Yeah.
And they're stuck in the back of a car together for an hour and a half.
Yes.
And it's fairly well documented that by the end of it, by the end of the process at least, they were nicknamed the Chuckle Brothers.
Yeah.
They became a very, very functional partnership. And so the film imagines what the hell must have happened.
Yes. So just to be clear, the word imagines is key there, Steve. This is a little bit of a cinematic contrivance. Yeah, what I mean is, let's be clear, there wasn't an actual journey in the back of a car like this. There was a coming together of their minds to form the Chuckle Brothers, but this is like one writer's interpretation of how it might have played out. So there's a real people and the setting is real, but the actual incident isn't real.
I think it's important to stress that quite clearly, isn't it? Because there must have been some form of melting of the ice, especially.
Yes.
I mean, the way it's portrayed is that McGuinness, played beautifully by Colm Meaney, who doesn't put a single foot wrong in the entire film. Reaches out from the very beginning. He realizes he's stuck in the car with Paisley, and it's either going to be the most buttock-clenchingly awkward journey known to man, or they can try and do something.
Yeah. Well, actually, I think we both saw this a little while ago now. We were lucky to get a preview seat for it, but it seemed like actually McGuinness set out. He was the one who had the agenda, wasn't he? He was the one who was trying to make Paisley come to an understanding and make a deal. And so that's part of the dynamic of it, isn't it?
That's a very fair point, yes.
And Paisley is the one who's has to be persuaded. He has to be won over somehow, this, as you say, implacable enemy. like you, I found the performances of the two actors fantastic. I mean, although we're a long way from it here in New Zealand, Steve, New Zealanders of my generation would have seen the real Ian Paisley on their TV news for many, many years, and that distinctive voice and the heavy jowls and the threatening manner about him. So I thought that we really did see Ian Paisley on the screen very, very well. excuse me, my cold again. That just worked. That part worked really well. The contrivance of it slightly played on my mind a little bit, but the script is a wonderful one. The backwards and forwards, McGinnis trying desperately to find a little glimmer of light to prize open the door to get a conversation going with Paisley. There's some really nicely scripted and tense moments around that, isn't there?
There is. I mean, like I say, you've got Colin Meaney playing McGinnis as a twinkling Irishman.
Yes.
Not overplayed, though. I think he did it very well, but he's definitely got sort of the Irish wit and charm. Whereas, yes. I think if possibly, oddly enough, if there were a weak link in this film, it would be Timothy Spall, which is an odd thing to have to say.
Now, tell me more why you think he is the weaker link.
He was a very, very physical portrayal of Ian Paisley.
Yeah.
However, it felt a little one note to me, almost tending toward caricature.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. The real man was almost a larger than life person who almost that's an interesting point. I mean, he. Okay, well, you're a Brit, and you probably, you grew up much closer to this than I did from the distance.
I'm a Brit of Irish Catholic descent.
Yeah, yes.
So obviously, I mean, I have a dog in this race, very definitely.
And
as I say, of Irish Catholic descent, my political, and I stress only, my political sympathies were with the Republican side.
Yeah.
And it did bother me also very slightly that while Paisley is very keen to call McGinnis to account for his terrorist activities, which are well documented. We know McGinnis was a gunman for the IRA. He was part of the IRA High Command. There's no secrets being divulged there. But nobody really takes the trouble to point out that Paisley was no angel either. Paisley at least kept daylight between himself and the loyalist paramilitaries, but he was up to his neck in it as well. But the script kind of gives him a little bit of a free pass, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's interesting. That might be so, and I think in a way the acting task is a greater task for Timothy Spall, because he's got to take Paisley from the steadfast against even talking to McGinnis to that rapprochement.
Yes.
And that is, so he's got to travel that arc, whereas McGinnis is firmly in, I want to win you over right from the start.
Now, that's a very fair point, yes.
I think there's some credence to that, what you say. One thing that did bother me a little bit, there's probably been one or two British films now, Steve, where I've seen portrayals of Tony Blair,
right,
as a bit of a twat, to be honest with you, and or is it twat? How do you pronounce it? He again in this one, and I thought, I know he has been ridiculed in many quarters and vilified in others, was he really that much of a buffoon as is portrayed here? I don't know.
I wonder about that. In Britain, basically, yeah, it's extraordinarily politically unfashionable to have anything good to say about Blair.
Yes.
However, you make a very fair point. I mean, he, along with his Northern Ireland Secretary, Mo Molam, did an awful lot of good in trying to pull the two sides together. And there is a case to be made for there having been, that there would have been no peace process were it not for Blair. But
yeah.
It's saying something when a pair of terrorists get a more sympathetic reading than he does.
Yes.
But that is, you're quite right, where we are left. He is portrayed as a buffoon. Toby Stevens in this case. But yeah, that's the typical reading that we get of Tony Blair these days.
He is
constantly licking his finger and sticking it in the wind to see which way the political wind is going.
Yes, that's right, yes.
I think an altogether more deserving of praise turn,
yes,
would be again the reason that we see a lot of Tony Blair is that there's a contrivance that the driver of the car
is
a stooge,
yes,
for the security forces who's trying to coax these two blokes into talking together, and he's getting his leads through a wireless earpiece,
right,
from John Hurt.
Yes, yes. In what probably was, I guess, his last role. I think so. I mean, he has sadly passed away in recent months, John Hurt, and I'm not sure if he did a film after this one, but it would
Yeah. According to IMDb, there's one or two that came after. Did you see Jackie, the Jackie Onassis film?
Oh, no, I didn't.
He plays her father confessor in that.
Oh, okay.
And I'm not quite sure which one came later, but there's certainly... Okay. Around the same time. But yeah, this is one of his last turns. And, well, I mean, he's John Hurt. I don't know what else you can say about him.
No, it's a very lovely piece of work he does. He delivers there.
He really does. So what do you reckon? I mean, again, you and I are coming from very different backgrounds on this. I know you are a politically conscious individual, but you don't have but you don't have my closeness to it. Would you buy a ticket?
I would. No, I would. I think that, you know, we've identified one or two possible, you know, little weak spots, but overall you've got a really powerful piece of drama. It is based around the conversations between the two men largely. They're both very accomplished actors. It's well scripted. It's about events that are not that far away in our history. And even if you're not a Brit or of British descent and you are like me just growing up in New Zealand, you could not have, you know, failed to have taken notice of these two characters. Paisley probably more so. I remember Paisley being on the TV seemed like all the time when I was growing up. So I think it's fascinating. And it is a contrivance, but it's a fascinating contrivance to see how two such opposed characters could have come together. So I think it's well worth the price of a ticket.
I'd have to agree with you. I mean, I don't know that it's for everybody. I think those of us who are of a mind to appreciate the political shenanigans going on between the two are going to get more out of it. But for those who are interested in that kind of thing, I would definitely agree.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, then. Good. Now, more British fare.
Yes, more serious British fare.
Yes, yes. We're talking about a film. This is one I caught just the other week. Steve, I don't think you managed to catch this one, but I'd be interested in one or two. I've got one or two questions for you on this one. This is an adaptation of the Daphne du Maurier novel, My Cousin Rachel.
Right.
The film's come out just in recent times. It's I hadn't read the book, but we're talking about a Victorian era romance mystery, almost a thriller in some ways. My Cousin Rachel, played by Rachel Weisz. And the story is, it's a kind of a twisty sort of a plot, but basically it's based around a chap called Philip Ashley, played by Sam Claflin. He's adopted as a young lad by his much older cousin called Ambrose. And young Philip looks upon Ambrose as his father. He's devoted to him. But when Ambrose gets sick, he leaves his English county manor and he goes to spend time in the warmer climate of Italy. And there we hear from through letters and the like, he falls in love and marries his cousin, Rachel Weisz. Now, that's all fine. It's a bit of a complicated setup. So we've got young Philip in England, the older cousin Ambrose in Italy. Then there's this distressing letter which arrives from Ambrose in which he says, oh, no, it's not what I thought at all. My health is failing and I've been subjected to the evil designs of my cousin Rachel.
Ooh.
Great shock for young Philip. So he heads to Italy to confront said Rachel and to rescue his beloved father figure, Ambrose. Ambrose is dead by the time he gets there. I'm not giving away too much plot. There's a lot more to come. That's just the setup. So that's the setup to the guts of the story, which is when young Philip meets Rachel, what's going to happen? The tension is all around whether Rachel will cast a similar spell over the youngster as she did over the old man. And that's really how it all plays out for the rest of the film. Which most of the time we're being led to believe that Rachel is a very skilled manipulator and a schemer out for the family riches. But there is enough going on to suggest there could just be another explanation. So it's never completely sealed there, that question. I made a note as I was watching it, particularly as we got into the middle part of the film, Steve, I thought this feels like a Hitchcock movie. There was a bit of the twists of it.
And Hitchcockian air about it?
Yeah. And I didn't realize until later, and this is my ignorance, that in fact Hitchcock had adapted another du Maurier novel or novelette to the screen. The Birds was one of her stories. So that was just a lucky kind of guess on my part. It was Well acted. Rachel Weisz plays Rachel very well. She keeps us guessing. She plays the character as both vulnerable yet beguiling. She kind of reels the young Philip in, and then she eases him off, and then she reels him in again. So all that is very clever acting. Yeah. You don't really feel you ever truly know what the real Rachel is all about, and I guess that's a credit to Rachel Weisz's acting.
Now, I'm hearing the most enormous but about to come over the horizon here.
There is a but. I just felt I was with this film for two thirds, I'd say.
Okay.
But somewhere as we crested into that final third, there's a terrible thing to admit, but I have to admit it. I started to lose some interest.
Oh, lordy.
Yes. It's not because the actors weren't acting well or the script wasn't good. I just started to feel, and maybe this is me not having, you know, your erstwhile British heritage or a sense of these stories. I just started to think, you know what? This is a story of a young man who's inherited a lot of wealth, who's a bit naive, and he's fallen under the wiles of an older, beautiful woman. And I don't know. Do I really care about that? It seemed for all the quality of the production and the acting, the actual story started to fade away a little bit for me.
So what you're saying is basically Alfred Hitchcock does Jane Austen, doesn't speak to you.
It's about the speaking to me part, whether it's a political thing or just a cultural thing. I mean, we do have many, many people in New Zealand, of British heritage. And even me, who is not a British heritage, grew up being
exposed.
Exposed, thank you, to many, many excellent examples of British culture, drama and comedy and everything else. So I'm certainly open to it. But I just got to a point where I thought, it's had this sort of thing before, Poll Dark and all that sort of carry on. I'm not sure I'm that bothered anymore. And so it's a bit harsh, perhaps. And I think I could tell, I have to say, to be fair, that there were others in the auditorium a little older than me who I could tell were relishing it and enjoying it enormously. So this is more a reflection of me, perhaps, than the actual production. But for whatever reason, it didn't quite grab me by the end. I just think because we didn't really get to know who Rachel was, that there was a sort of coldness to that character. You didn't really know what the motivations were. I guess it could have been just greed. But I would have liked to know her better, and I didn't.
Right.
And so I therefore it became a bit distant from her. As good an actress as she is.
And I think losing your interest is possibly the most crushing condemnation I can imagine.
Yeah, I know. And as I say, there would be others who would disagree with me most vehemently, and I think it's generally had very good reviews. So this is my twisted view of it.
No, fair enough then. So I'm not hearing a resounding endorsement or a recommendation of ticket purchase.
No, not a resounding endorsement. I think if you do like British period drama and romantic drama, yes, absolutely, you'll enjoy it. If it's not your most... Oh, dear. There'll be an edit. Excuse me, Steve. There'll be an edit there.
This is commitment to the Crave cause, this is, isn't it?
It is.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm just getting over a winter cold.
I can hear it.
Yes. So if you are into the British romantic period dramas, you'll love it. If it's not your cup of tea, you'll appreciate the acting, but I don't know if you'll absolutely give it a big tick. That's probably the best I could. I'm sort of glad I saw it, but not brilliantly glad I saw it. I do like Rachel Weisz. I think she's good. An actress well worth watching, but the story just didn't quite get me.
Fair enough. Fair enough. So we shall move on then, shall we?
Let's do.
Let's shrink the screen a little.
Yes, I think we should. I'd like to pass the baton to you for a few minutes, Steve. Yes, you're ready to accept it. I know. We've both been working our way through. It's still a pretty new series on, well, it's available on probably a number of media, but Lightbox is one, where I've been watching it. This is The Handmaid's Tale,
based on the Margaret Atwood
novel. Yeah.
This is the Margaret Atwood story. It's the as is very popular these days, the dystopian future.
Yes.
But not the dystopian futures we expect to see in teenage and young adult fiction. It's a damn sight darker and bleaker than that. This is set in a fictionalized America that's basically become a theocracy called Gilead, following a revolution which appears to have been brought about by an environmental catastrophe, which, among other things, has left most women infertile. And so we end up with a scenario in which fertile women are effectively enslaved as handmaids, who are most of the month they are domestic servants and staff for the households of the commanders, who are the unspecified upper echelons of the new society of Gilead. But once a month at their fertile time, they are then the concubines of the commanders. Yes.
And it's to say sexual slave.
Well, as I said, they are enslaved. There's no two ways about it.
No.
They are obliged to be serviced, shall we say. In the most tawdry way imaginable.
Yes.
By their owners.
Yes. Both of them are there at the time.
Yes, the husband and the wife.
Yeah.
And so the Handmaid's Tale is told from the point of view of Offglen. I beg your pardon, not Offglen, Offred.
Offred.
Yes, Offred. But you'll notice a theme there. These women no longer have their own names.
No.
They now take the names of the men who now basically own them. So Offred is the handmaid of Fred.
Of Fred Waterford, who's the commander, yes.
Yes. And Offred is played quite remarkably by Elizabeth Moss in, I think you'll agree with me, some of the most understated, elegant, sophisticated acting I've seen in quite some time.
I wholeheartedly agree. I thought it's a really compelling, intelligent, subtle performance, given the dire situation the character is in, to be able to draw a degree of sort of finding how a real person would react under these circumstances is a real credit to Elizabeth Moss. I thoroughly enjoyed her performance. She starts slowly and it just builds and builds. I should just quickly note, Steve, I've only finished half of the 10 episodes. I've finished five.
Yep.
So you, I think you've seen all of them, haven't you?
I have, and it's slow. Let's be honest about this. It's slow, but in a way that sort of builds a terrifying mood.
Yeah, I agree.
It wants to be slow because it makes you realise the nightmare that she's trapped in. She really is enslaved, and we start to see little by little how through flashbacks how the universe that she now occupies came about.
Yes. Yeah.
And how she went from a free, prosperous, intelligent young woman with a family of her own to the slave who is put to service trying to breed for her oppressors. The arc that she sent through is frankly terrifying, and she plays it in the most dignified and, as you say, elegant manner. It's superb.
Yeah, it is superb. I think it is superb. The way it's done, the way it's presented, is also worth just quickly talking about. A great deal of time is spent looking at Offred's face and her reactions.
Yes.
And following her around. She is very much the central person. We do meet some of the other characters, and they are important, but the focus is her. And this works well because if you're trying to tell a story about the transformation of a whole society, this allows you to personalize it, but also you don't have to spend quadrillions of dollars building entire cities and street scenes. And, you know, it enables you to tell it in quite a personal, private, small way in terms of the sets and everything else. And that works quite well. It makes it more real.
It does. The claustrophobia that she experiences, the closing of the walls, figuratively speaking, that she lives within, focuses your attention on you could easily simply say, oh, this is just a huge, great, big dystopian future. No, this is one woman's dystopian future.
Yes, and leading from that, I think, is the other interesting thing. I'm halfway through, Steve, so I'm up to the part where we're beginning to understand that beyond the confines of Offred's world, there is some sort of a broader rebellion beginning to bubble away. But we are also very much seeing that within the her own world, the house that she inhabits and the shopping trips that she goes to, she is herself beginning to understand more the power plays and the politics, the sexual politics between the husband and wife she's the property of. And she's beginning to see how, in her own private way, she can begin to construct some sort of resistance. So I think that's a fascinating aspect of the story that I'm beginning to really appreciate as I'm halfway through it.
Very definitely. I think it's also worth having a quick mention of the supporting cast. Well, I mean, this is without doubt Moss's show. She anchors it and she carries it.
Yeah.
Splendidly.
Yeah.
We've got Joseph Fiennes playing the commander.
Yes.
With reptilian elegance.
Yeah, he's very good.
He's very good. Are you familiar with Samira Wiley as Moira, who was in Orange is the New Black?
I've enjoyed her performance. I'm not that familiar with the actress, but I've enjoyed her performance very much.
Yeah, another one who generally speaking, can do little wrong. We've got Anne Dowd plays Aunt Lydia, who is, I mean, it's interesting. There's at one point a woman is condemned as a gender traitor.
Yes.
And yet Aunt Lydia, who is basically one of the overseers of the slaves, is the ultimate gender traitor who keeps the handmaids and the other women firmly and brutally in their places. She's fantastic.
I made a note of that too. I thought Anne Dowd is absolutely captivating when she is on the screen. It made me think, you know, some of all the famous baddies we've seen in cinematic history. If you think of Nurse Pratchett from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Yes.
Even at least as good as that, if not better. She, with not a lot of screen time, not a massive amount of script, she just nails it and gives you the creeps.
Just wonderful, subtly pleasing amount of malevolence.
Yes.
And also worth a mention in the accent stakes is that the commander's wife, Serena Joy, is played by Yvonne Strahovski, who is from Sydney.
Yes. Now, she's an Aussie, is she?
Yes.
Yeah.
And you'd never guess it.
Of Polish descent. No, you wouldn't. No.
You'd be looking at IMDb as well, haven't you?
I have, yes. There's an excellent cast. It's nothing. You're not looking at a Game of Thrones or anything like that. This is, as Steve says, slower but clever, enthralling, compelling, confronting.
Yes, I'll take that.
It's not. I wonder, we almost need to be talking to a woman, Steve, to get the female perspective on what Offred has to go through. But as you say, because she is a piece of property.
Yes.
She's no free will, really. She has to do what she's told. She can't even crack a joke or anything like that. And she is expected to, as you say, be serviced by the people who own her. So, I don't know. Has Debbie seen much of this? Your wife, Debbie?
No. Debbie's planning to start watching it with what? I'm going to rewatch it. I want to see it again.
And it'll be best that I know what she says later.
Well, it's worth revisiting because this is it's being delivered in an interesting way. It was released as a piece on Hulu, the streaming service in the United States. It's then been put out on Lightbox as a single thing to be binge watched here in New Zealand. And in Britain, it's being drip fed once a week.
Oh, is that right?
It's a weekly series. Yes. Yeah, it is and it isn't the streaming binge watch, depending on where you are in the world.
Okay.
And so I think it will be worth revisiting when Debbie's had a chance to watch it, when you've finally seen the end of it.
Yeah, I think it is worth. I think I'd be very happy to do that. Let's do that. Okay, excellent. Very good. That's a good mix of content this week, I'd say, Mr. McCabe.
Not by Mr. Mercer, but a decent combination there, yes.
Yes. Look, we should just quickly look ahead, though. There's because it's the middle of our winter, but it's the summer season in the northern hemisphere. They've got all these big blockbuster movies. We've seen some of them already. There's more coming. And then literally in the next week or two, aren't there? Spider-Man is just around the corner.
Yeah.
I think another Planet of the Apes movie is just around the corner.
Yeah.
There's some other ones. Yeah, so it's that time of the year, basically. And there's a film festival not far away as well for those looking for a different type of fare.
This is certainly true, yes. Starting in a couple of weeks, we've got the Auckland Film Festival.
Yeah, which will go to Wellington. I'm just trying to remember off the top of my head whether it goes further afield than that. I'm not sure if it does, but I think it might be just Auckland, Wellington. But anyway, some of them will come out on general releases as well.
Well, it's worth mentioning, to be fair, technically it's actually the New Zealand International Film Festival.
All right, yes.
But you know, there are actually other cities in New Zealand, Simon. I need to remind you of this sometimes, don't
I? Thank you so much. Thank you. Yes. I'll take that point.
But yeah, it's basically 14th of July through to the 6th of August. NZIFF.co.nz is the place to go to find a lot of information about the films that are being shown.
Yeah, good. Okay. Well, anything else that you've noted that coming up soon? Of course, I should say before you answer that question that anyone who wants to catch up more in writing, go to our website, cravepodcast.com, because Steve keeps us up to date very, very well with notices of all the major concerts coming up.
This is true.
Yes.
But films worth mentioning, as you say, Spider-Man
mm-hmm.
coming out next week. I mean, I'm actually having a quick look at the moment. At the current box office top 10 in New Zealand, and I'm seeing Despicable Me 3, Transformers, Wonder Woman, Cars, we've got The Mummy, and then, as you say, we've got Spider-Man coming up, we've got War for the Planet of the Apes is opening on July the 12th, and I just find myself thinking, are there no new films? No one got a new idea anywhere. And the one that I'm very, very keen to see, which is going to be opening in a couple of weeks, is one called Baby Driver. Are you familiar with this?
Oh, yes. I've just seen a bit of publicity about it. It sounds like it's for those who enjoyed La La Land, it might be their cup of tea again. This is a kind of a musical crime story or something, is it?
It's sort of a musical-ish crime caper directed by the British director, Edgar Wright, who is behind films like Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead.
Right. Well, that sounds interesting. Goodness.
That's going to be brilliant. I'm really looking forward to that one.
I must ask you I think it's a slightly further away, but not that far away. Another British director, very well known, has got a film coming out. Are you looking forward to seeing Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk?
Oh, very much. We've talked about this before, haven't we?
Yeah.
My teenage daughter, who's a massive Harry Styles fan, can't wait to see it. And she was asking me this evening, will I be coming with her the day it opens? And yes,
okay.
yes, I absolutely will. It does look very good. I think she and I want to see it for very, very different reasons.
Fair enough.
But yeah, we'll be there.
Okay, good.
Definitely. And then also, it's worth mentioning some of the music that's coming up very shortly.
Yes, do let's.
Well, we mentioned last week that Queen and Adam Lambert are doing an actual proper New Zealand tour.
I know, at the Spark.
Is it still Spark this week?
Yes.
They're also going to be playing elsewhere in New Zealand.
I'm glad to hear it.
Absolutely. But, like I say, they've added a second night to their...
Auckland run?
Yes. The Auckland run. I lost for words for a second then, yeah. They're added a second night to Auckland.
Yeah.
But even that is eclipsed by, and this is possibly... I don't know how good a show it's going to be, but I have a feeling this is the big music announcement, bigger even than Adele cancelling her shows in London to massive public opprobrium.
Yes.
Paul McCartney's coming over.
Yeah, I saw that. Gosh, I know. And I immediately thought, you know, there'll be a lot of people who think he's never going to come back. This will be the last chance to see a guy who occupies such a place in popular music history, and I'm sort of thinking that myself, actually, Steve. He's not my his post Beatles music wasn't. I wasn't a huge fan of it at all. But it's Paul McCartney. He's a living legend, for goodness' sake.
I mean, he's a Beatle.
He's a Beatle. Yes.
You could forgive a multitude of sins just for that one single statement.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, to be fair, he did the best James Bond theme tune ever.
That's true. That's yes.
Quite frankly, for me, he could skip the Beatles songs and just play that, and I'd be a happy boy. But what really matters is that he will be playing it, I hope, on December the 16th, Saturday the 16th of December at Mount Smart Stadium.
Okay.
Good. That's his only New Zealand show. It'll be his first since 1993.
Ooh, okay. Okay.
But, I mean, he's also playing the West Island for a few dates, but that's going to be his only show here in New Zealand.
Well, he will sell that place sell it out easily, I'm sure. I just can't imagine.
Entirely surprised to see a second date added to that one, but we will keep the good people of New Zealand and the rest of the world who are listening to us through various internet means informed on that one. But yeah, I wouldn't be at all surprised to see a second date added.
I don't know how much of a gap he'd need between shows to recover.
Have his probably he must have been at least a pair of artificial hips by now that need to be re-oiled. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, how old is he? Isn't he 70?
I was just looking up. Yeah, he was born in 42, so he's 75.
Wow.
Gosh.
He's looking good, isn't he?
He's looking pretty good. Yeah, yeah.
Let's hope he still sounds good at 75.
Yeah. Wow.
But you're right. This has got to be your last chance to see, sure.
I need to just tell you something. This is very quickly, at the risk of going on for too long.
Go on.
Such is the influence of the Beatles, the generation-spanning influence of the Beatles. I have a 5.5-year-old grandson who started singing to me the other day, Eleanor Rigby.
Wow.
He'd heard it at his home, but his parents' house. But I mean, wow!
I was expecting a Bruce Springsteen tie-in there.
No. I'll leave Bruce out of this one. No, that's all the Beatles. But there you are. So
that is quite remarkable.
It is. Right. So okay. So a lot to look forward to, but later in the year. In the meantime, thank you very much for listening, Steve. I'm actually. Will be absent from these good shores for 3 weeks, going to visit family who I haven't seen in many, many years in Canada. We might see if we can do something while I'm in Canada, but just in case we don't, we'll be having a slightly longer gap between podcasts. But
are we having an on-air production meeting here?
We are now. Yes, we are. Don't fret if you don't hear from us again super, super soon. We'll still have to keep our website updated as regularly as we do. We do like to hear from you. If you've got anything to say to us, many ways you can do it. You can email us, and the address is podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter @CravePodcast.
You can. So, I'm Simon Mercep.
I'm Steve McCabe.
And that's what's been entertaining us this week.
Brilliant.
Lovely.